welcome to the brand new What's So Funny, a new podcast produced by mnartists.org about the making of comedy. How is comedy made? How are jokes written? What do the people who make comedy think about? This is a show not just for people who make comedy or love comedy, but for anybody who is a creative person, a maker of things, or interested in the creative process. I'm your host, Levi Weinhagen. I will be sitting down with various creative folks once a month and talking to them about the writing of jokes and comedy performance. And I hope you guys will enjoy it. This first episode features stand-up comedian Ben Sandell out of Minneapolis, and we talked about a few of his jokes specifically, as well as his process overall. If you have feedback on the show, if you have suggestions for guests we should reach out to, any ideas or thoughts, anything at all, you can hit me up on Twitter. I'm at ThatLevi. You can also go to mnartist.org to find links to this episode, and that's where future episodes will live. I hope you will do so. If you like the show, please share it with other people you know who may like it. Tweet about it. Put it on Facebook. Put it all over the internet. Let's spread it around the world. You can also rate and review it on iTunes, and I hope you'll do so. It really helps the show a lot. I appreciate you listening. And now, here is Ben Sandell. Hello and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You are Ben Sandell.
I hope so.
You are a stand-up comic. You're also a writer of stage work. You are an actor sometimes. You're a storyteller.
Occasionally, yep.
But I feel like stand-up comedy is where you've been putting the most of your time and energy.
Yeah, it's probably my main focus. There was a couple years in 2010, 2011 where I put focus on playwriting and directing a play. But other than that, yeah, it's been pretty much. And then I do storytelling with the Rockstar Storytellers. And but that has sort of morphed into me just using our themes of the month and doing stand-up comedy on those themes.
Yeah, yeah.
And trying to pretend that it's a story.
Well, there are different stand-up styles. There is sort of a story style of stand-up versus a joke style of stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like you're on one end of the spectrum?
No, I do both.
Yeah.
I do all sorts of... I just steal, you know, and it's kind of whatever...
You mean ways of doing or jokes themselves?
No joke I've ever written has been my actual... No, I...
Nice.
I...
That's why you have all that Latino stuff.
Uh-huh.
What it's like to be Latino.
You know, when you're living in Brazil, and I don't know, that's not Latino, but...
No, that could be a thing that happens to you, just being in Brazil.
When you live in Brazil, and you lose all your body hair. That's the only thing I know about Brazil is the Brazilian wax, because I am a naive white guy. That's really what it comes down to.
Solid.
No, I mean, I guess it's, I do a lot of research of comedy, mm-hmm. So I watch comedy all the time, of all different sorts, and I read comedy, and whatever the comedy I'm watching at the time, whatever that style is, I will sort of adopt that style accidentally for a while, and I won't steal the jokes, but just the, like, if I'm watching Bill Burr, and he has more of a confrontational,
aggressive
style that's usually taking some sort of sacred cow and flipping it, tipping, I should have said tipping. That would have been the appropriate word choice for that.
Yeah, and that's not, I mean, that is not uncommon of when people start comedy, but you continue to do that. Like, as you see a comic who's doing something a certain way, you'll try out.
See, I try to do it with enough different comics that I never feel like I am just, you know, taking from one particular style. Mm-hmm. So if I don't want to be like, oh, that he's doing Bill Burr.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I want to research Bill Burr and then immediately research Ellen DeGeneres and then see if there's any kind of, like, something comes out of my head that sort of has a mixture of those two styles, because those are completely different styles, but, you know, possibly there's something there that if you combine Ellen DeGeneres, who also has a sort of a Jack Handy style. Jack Handy, who, by the way, is real.
Yes, a real. We wrote those deep thoughts for SNL.
I was telling another comedian friend of mine that I love Jack Handy, and he was like, that's Al Franken, wasn't it? And I'm like, no, he's Jack Handy is a person.
I think he put out. I think he wrote an essay in the New Yorker several years ago that was about how he was real. Like, I think Jack Handy wrote a piece that was...
Which made him seem even more fictional.
Yes,
so,
that is exactly what happened.
But Jack Handy does this. He writes from the style of a idiot psychopath.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the psychopath idiot narrator I'll start writing from that style, but it doesn't fit with if I'm then do a joke from Bill Burr's style. Those two suddenly I'm not the idiot psychopath. I'm a serious person talking about the feminism in this country, and so that's been my biggest struggle as a comedian is trying to find a way to make all these this patchwork quilt sort of seem like it's of a whole.
Because you want it to blend. Like, it's interesting, the quilt example. In a quilt, you can see this is where these two things intersect. Here's a line where they've been sewn together.
Mm-hmm.
But your goal is sort of like if you mix a bunch of different Play-Doh colors together. I'm going to go with more weird stuff.
Well, hopefully.
You can't, eventually, if you mash it all up, you can't see where's the pink part of this and where's the green part and, like, Is it more like you're talking about some styles just don't, they would cancel each other out. Like if you do a Jack Handy bit, people won't believe the realism you need for the Bill Burr thing where you're going to say something that even you don't necessarily agree with, just so you can experiment with sort of losing and winning the audience back, which is not what Jack Handy would do. He would just be like, you guys are going to be confused and then there's going to be a crazy left turn where it's going to be revealed I'm a horrible monster.
Yeah. Well, the problem is if the audience is expecting one character, then if you do a different character, then their expectations are sort of jarred in that way. So, for example, I've been opening with a joke where I say, "Hey, everybody, y'all." Apparently, I'm a Southern guy now. This is too early in the morning, and it's 1 p.m.
It's the afternoon.
Oh, my God. That's the other thing about stand-up comedians is that mostly we're crazy night people, and this is the morning to me right now.
Yeah. I want to get you fresh.
You know, if you're going to do a comedy podcast, you should do it at night around whiskey.
You're right.
This is not...
I appreciate the note.
I am out of the... I'm a fish out of the... God. I'm a fish out of the whiskey right now. What was I talking about?
I think you're right. I think, actually, I don't think this is off topic at all. At, like, 1 in the morning is probably a good time to talk to a comic about.
You know, the best time to talk would be after an early show,
were they processing something that just happened?
Yeah, they just got off stage at, like, 10 p.m., there's an hour before the next show, and then their minds are in this adrenaline state where they just got off being the character with the microphone and dealing with the audience, and that would be...
Well, so if, you know, one in the afternoon is like, oh, God, it's so early, when is your... I know you're developing material on stage, but when are you processing and writing? Like, do you feel like there's certain times of day when actual more joke writing is happening than other times of day?
The time that I write usually the best jokes is when I am preparing for an open mic that is going to be in an hour. So I will spend the whole weekend trying to work on jokes and not come up with anything. And then with the pressure of having to go and do new stuff at the open mic, I will take a shower or a bath and have an idea, and then kind of come up with a 5-minute set. Right before I go on stage, I'll agonize the entire week about not coming up with material, and then I'll just think of something right there that'll become my best joke that I've thought of in the entire week. And there's something about that, the pressure of the adrenaline of having to go on stage that sort of inspires my... There's been times where I've been, where I've thought of a joke while I'm waiting kind of backstage to go up, and it will usually be the best of the new jokes that I've written. And it's just, there's something about that. What was I talking about before we talked about the being night people? There was something I was going to...
Oh, well, you were talking about the aping other styles.
Oh, yeah, I was going to do an example. Okay, so, yeah, let's go back briefly to... this is how my mind works. I'm all over the place. This is why I like comedy, too. Is when I go on stage, I have this plan. and I'm in complete control. I have a microphone. The audience is trained to just listen and not talk back. I don't have to kind of come up with stuff on the spot. A lot of people talk to me like, wait a minute, you do stand-up comedy? I'm like, yeah, because I can talk when I know exactly what I'm going to say. It's when I don't know what I'm going to say is when I can't talk. It's when I'm doing a podcast that I'm suddenly like, I guess I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. But I can pretend for half hour or an hour on stage that I do know what I'm talking about.
Well, you've had time to mull over the words, the phrasing, to how to say what you mean.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's just, you write a joke, you write a new joke, and the joke kind of works on stage, and it's far from being complete, so you have to bring it out again and again and again, and you add a certain line, you take a line away, and you do that over, I'd say there's some jokes that I do, some stories that have been in the works for 4 years, or a joke that I used to do that kind of was okay, it never quite got the kind of laughs that I wanted, so then I retired it, and then I decided, you know what, I'm going to revisit it 2 years later, and then I rework it, like the order of the lines, I'm more talented now with experience, so I can take that story and turn it into something that actually gets the reaction that I wanted. But it just took that 2 years to have it sit aside for a while.
So I'll get you back to that aping styles thing, but just you talking about that process, it occurs to me, if you have something you develop for months or years, and then either you have a realization about what it needed, maybe you needed a different word to start it, or you found a tag that opened up the whole rest of the joke or something. Mm-hmm. Is there a feeling of excitement? Is it more relief? Like, oh, I finally figured this out? Or is it like, I mean, does that feel like that is a payoff for all that hard work? Or is there any element of like, I spent this long and that's what I get? Like, it's a moment on stage, which is what you're chasing. Uh-huh. Like, is that great? Or is there any like disappointment?
Yeah, well, one of the best feelings I ever have is when I come up with something new and then it works on stage.
Mm-hmm.
I learned long ago that just because I'm excited about something that I thought of does not mean it's going to work on stage. Mm-hmm. So I'll be cautiously optimistic. Like, I'll have an idea and think, all right, that's a cool idea. And I'll get excited, but I'm like, yeah, I can't get too excited. I can't tell you how many times I've thought, you know what? If I'm on Letterman, this joke I just thought of, this is going to be my closing joke. I'm going to get a standing ovation for this joke when I tell it tonight, and then I'll tell it on stage, and it will get zero laughs. It'll be like my worst joke that I've ever told. And so I've learned that kind of confidence in what I write doesn't mean anything. And a lot of times, something that I write, and I'll be like, this is not going to be funny, will end up being my closing joke.
Yeah. So, it's like buying a lottery ticket and then going and buying a boat right away without waiting to see the results of your lottery ticket. You're just like, I got this ticket. I know it's going to win. I'm going to go ahead and just invest now.
It's like getting the first four numbers matched.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then getting really excited.
Nothing.
But you still have a 1 in 100 chance of getting that last number right. So, yeah, you got to wait. But then if it hits, then that's great. Because you get to the point where you're surprised something hits. Like, I've kind of found that about a third of my new jokes, if I write a joke, there's about a 30% chance it'll work. So there's that surprise. And once in a while, you'll have a streak where just nothing works.
Yeah.
And you'll think, no, okay, I lost my superpower to write jokes. Because I don't know how. There's no formula for writing jokes. There's no science behind joke writing. Like, this is how you write a joke that will guarantee that it's funny. You don't know it's going to be funny until you take it on stage. And you don't know why you're able to write funny jokes. And because of that, it's just something that comes out of you that could just as easily not come out of you. And so if you go for a while and you can't make the audience laugh, then you just think, well, that's it. I've written my last funny joke 2 weeks ago, and now I'm done.
Well, what do you do if that happens? Do you just keep writing lousy jokes and hope they... you burn through enough lousy ones?
Or usually what happens is I will decide I'm going to quit comedy, and then I will tell everybody I'm going to quit comedy, and then I'll get very secure in the idea that, you know what, I'm just going to do the steady life. I'm going to get a more full-time, steady job, and then a joke will occur to me. It will just pop up in my head, and I'll be like, well, I can't quit comedy, I gotta tell this joke, because I can't just sit there, and then I'll tell the joke, and it'll work, and then I'll be like, oh, I can do this again, and then I'll have a streak where I write a bunch of jokes that get laughs, and it sort of has this, I've gone through this cycle over and over again. I've decided I was gonna quit comedy probably 10 times in my career so far.
That sounds very similar to, like, a tumultuous dating relationship, where you're like, everything's great and it's intense and passionate, and then there's some big blow up and you're like, I'm moving out, and then, you know, you time goes by, you reunite, and then it's crazy intense again and for different amounts of time,
make up sex.
Yeah, that's what doing that next set is, right? Like,
yeah, some of my best jokes, you could call them make up sex jokes. It's
when you're getting back together with comedy. Well,
because those periods where I decided to quit, when I come back a little bit better than I was before. Mm. So it's sort of this, I sort of grind to a halt where I kind of feel like I lost all my talent. I feel like I've not able to make an audience laugh. Even my old stuff isn't working anymore. And I'll just sort of crash and burn. And then I will come back after about a month or two and have a different perspective on comedy and have an extra confidence in it. It's almost like shedding your skin. It's like I needed to grow, and I needed to just kind of have this 2 months of failing in order to come back and then I'll be writing jokes that I think are my best jokes. And like this is the most complex joke that I've written in my life. You know, I'll have these periods where I'm like, this is the best stuff I've ever written, and I kind of feel that way. But once every 2 years, I'll have this step up in my skill, and it always comes after that crash.
So you're able to recognize that is sort of a part of that creation process for you?
I do now.
Yeah. But you think when it happens again, you'll be able to go, this is all part of it, or you'll be so in it, you'll just, but this time I really am quitting. Is that what happens?
It does help me get through it now when I kind of know what the pattern is, but still that feeling is so strong when you feel like you can't do it anymore, that your brain is telling you this is it, that what then you'll tell yourself is, well, yeah, before I came back, but this is for real this time.
Yeah.
There's no way I'm coming back this time. And so I'm going to go and get a 401k and start a family, and so that's...
I like your fallback plan. I was telling someone the other day, I'm in the middle of a show writing process for a stage thing right now, and I said, I'm at that place where I'm not sure if I'm a writer in here. Like, I'm thinking about quitting writing. I'm in that place of the writing process.
Yeah.
And he was also a writer, and he said, you mean the writing part? He was like, that's what that is. The part where you're like, I don't think I can do this. It's just not... It's not happening.
Well, if you're not suffering, if it's, you're not being tortured, then you're a weirdo.
I mean,
the writing process is painful, and it only does have those rewards when you do have those epiphanies, when it breaks through, and you go, that's what I'm missing. I mean, I'll experience that same thing when I'm doing playwriting. And it took me, when I was doing a play called The Nice Guy's Guide to Awkward Sex in 2010 in The Fringe, it took me forever to figure out what the ending was going to be. Mm-hmm. And the ending that I ended up writing, originally, I was not happy with. It was like, this is... But I can't. And then it just, like, after 2 months, something came to me that, oh, I can bring this earlier thing back from earlier in the play and bring it around to the ending and have this. And that... So after 2 months of just suffering... with thinking that this ending is just kind of blah, I had epiphany, and that, so it goes back to your earlier question, is that epiphany enough of a reward? And it must be, because you and I keep doing this.
It's true.
So we're just chasing that epiphany all the time. We're chasing the epiphany, and then we're chasing the subsequent laughs that hopefully that epiphany create. Because a lot of times the moments where I have that feeling where something comes into place in my head will result in something that really works well on stage. Which I guess is sort of contradictory to what I was saying earlier about having confidence in a joke and then doesn't. But that's an interesting thing. When you're writing jokes, the jokes that will just come to me in epiphany tend to be better. The jokes that I sort of grind out and force myself to write and always come off as forced in the end. So it's that whole aspect of you just got to wait for this joke to come to you. But that leaves you so vulnerable, because what if jokes never come to you again?
Well, but it's funny you said, you know, you've just got to wait. But in that description, you're clearly not just waiting. You're grinding out other jokes. And I wonder, like, would those epiphanies come to you if you just were sitting and never actually trying to work on jokes?
No.
You wouldn't have... You've sort of conditioned your brain, right, mm-hmm. to go, keep making jokes. Mm-hmm. I'll be here. I'll be ready for them.
It's almost like your brain is waiting for you to suffer the appropriate amount before it gives you this little gift. So you have to do that suffering for a while. Yeah, because if I don't write, the epiphanies don't come.
That's like a tithing or something you have to do. I don't know, some sort of paying indulgences to the church.
Yep, it's like the whipping your back.
That's joke writing.
Yeah, joke writing is whipping your back so that you can get into heaven later.
And heaven is just one joke working.
It's one joke working. Well, you know, as Angel says in the show Angel, if nothing we do matters, the only thing that matters is what we do. Every moment can be God. And in one moment can be a good joke.
Yeah. So everyone
dumbest thing I've ever said.
Everyone's playing the angel drinking game.
Mm-hmm.
Here's your first one. It took you a long time to get your angel quote.
I just revealed to the world how nerdy I can get. Wow.
Well, do you have a joke that you remember when you thought of it? And that is now, like, either something you use or even something you're not using anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But that was worthy of your energy.
I had a joke that... It was about being Minnesota Nice. And the setup went, Minnesota Nice is basically taking nice to an inappropriate level. And I am guilty of that. The other day I was walking across the street toward this building, and there was a guy standing outside the building, and he opened the door for me. I wasn't planning on going into that building, but I didn't want to hurt his feelings. So I said, thank you, and I walked inside. And I'm in there, standing there like an idiot. And that was the entire joke.
Mm-hmm.
And that would sometimes get a big laugh, and sometimes it wouldn't. And I realized that's still just a setup.
Yeah.
There's no punchline there. It took me about a year to realize that. And so then I sat down it took me about 3 hours trying to figure out how can I end this joke? Where could I go in? What could be the place that I could go into that is funny? So he opens the door for me. I didn't want to go into that building. So then I was thinking gynecologist clinic.
Right.
Like, yeah, no, my vagina needs... need some fixing. Yeah, it's a penis.
Yeah.
So that was where I went to first, and then I tried that, and that didn't really. It was okay. So I ended up going with is something kind of a similar idea, still a sort of a gender twist. What I realized is that I could repeat the pattern of the premise and use it as a punchline. So the premise was I wasn't planning on going into the building, but I didn't want to hurt his feelings. So I walked inside. Next thing I know, a stripper is offering me a lap dance. I wasn't planning on getting a lap dance, but I didn't want to hurt his feelings. And that's Minnesota Nice in a nutshell. Well, two nutshells shaved.
Yeah.
And that ended up completing the joke. And all I had to do... So the joke was there the entire time, but all I had to do is figure out that I just needed to come up with a scenario where I could repeat almost the exact same words that I said at the end of the premise, at the end of the setup, and that those same words could then be the punchline, because it flips the situation. And then it became a complete joke, but it took me a year to figure out what that punchline was. And it took
to get
me
to a dick joke.
Yeah, yeah,
it took you two years to get from a guy holding a door open into a dick joke.
To where the dick joke is. Yeah, you know, that's that's comedy for you.
I don't mean to boil it down. What I really like about that, you sharing that as an example, is that is literally like you found this joke of that took you into a room, and then you realized the joke needs to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
But literally, that was like, the somewhere else needed to be, where is this room?
Yeah.
So, like, it's a great example of, that's the problem with a lot of jokes that you're trying to build.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I can get to this one part, but then I need to figure out where I need to go next.
Yeah.
And that was literally and figuratively sort of the problem of that joke for you.
And then you also know that there's fertile ground here, that wherever I am, whatever room I'm in is a room I didn't want to be, so what kind of room would that be? So you kind of go, okay, what? But then the audience is also thinking, so you say strip club, and the audience is, they don't really laugh at that line, because they're like, okay, that's an obvious place then. So they don't laugh until you flip it and say, oh, a male strip club.
Right.
Because then people, you're just playing with the gender expectations, and then that works. So then you got ahead of the audience there, just briefly. And that's the whole key to comedy, is you get ahead of the audience. Then you say something that surprises them, but in retrospect, completely makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, and by using that exact same structure a second time, you've already primed them to sort of see the structure, too.
Yeah.
So then you're playing on the idea that they recognize what you're doing. So then you have to put a surprise in there, because they're like, I can see everything that's... Mm-hmm. Like, they suddenly feel like they're in that beautiful mind scene where they can just see things floating in front of them. And then you're like, you can't see anything.
But what surprises me about a lot of comedy and a lot of like twists in television shows or movies is that the closer you get to revealing, the more clues you give the viewers, the better the twist is. So, okay, what am I trying to say here? For example, I say, I didn't want to go inside, but I didn't want to hurt his... I wasn't planning to go inside, but I didn't want to hurt his feelings. I say that, and then the next thing I say, I was getting this... A stripper was offering me a lap dance. I wasn't planning to get in a lap dance, so I'm setting up the exact same thing I said. So it seems to me that everybody in the audience should know the next thing I'm going to say is
the same.
But
words.
I wasn't planning on. But they I didn't want to hurt his feelings.
Yeah.
But they don't expect me to say that. So I guess what I'm saying is, the closer you get to revealing what the twist is going to be without actually revealing the twist, the better it works.
That feels like story structure. Like
it's exactly story structure, and that's really what a joke is, just a story structure boiled down to 30 seconds. And for some reason, because of how short it is, it gets a laugh as opposed to a moment where somebody gasps or cries. The more you stretch it out, the more it turns into like the end of The Sixth Sense, where you see the twist, and you don't laugh at that twist.
Mm-hmm.
You go, oh, wow. But if that whole movie was boiled down to a minute, you probably would laugh.
Yeah.
In a way. I don't, I guess I don't know. I don't know why some twists lead to laughter and some twists lead to you having a different emotion. I have no idea. I guess that goes back to the whole idea of comedians really have no idea why what they do works.
Well, and it's funny, The Sixth Sense, that's just a movie full of death. Like, that is... But there's tons of comedy that's full of dark death stuff. But I think because of that quickness of it, you can laugh at some of the same content.
Yeah.
Because you're not sitting with it as long.
Yeah.
So it doesn't feel as heavy.
Yeah.
But I know there's great comics who I've listened to, and then you're like, an hour later, you think about what was actually being talked about.
Yeah.
And you could feel that, the weight of that thing. But that you're right, that speed actually makes a big difference in the funny versus, I don't know, dramatic or serious.
But that's the problem with trying to figure out comedy, is that there's no, like, you can come up with examples of a minute-long story that has a twist that doesn't create a laughter.
That's true.
Laugh, too.
The baby shoes, that six-word.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, That's very sad and very short.
And it's surprising. There's a trend online about two sentence horror stories. Yeah. And those have twists that give you chills as opposed to laughing. And there you can read those in 20 seconds. So, again, and then you can say, well, a joke works because the twist is benign. But that's not true. I have a joke where I say, sometimes I complain. Just to blow off steam, but I have a friend who's like, you can't complain. There are people in the world that have it way worse off than you. And I'm thinking, well, you know, yeah, but if you follow that logic, then the only person allowed to speak his complaints is the person who truly has it worse than everybody else, which is stupid. No way that guy has a tongue. And that's not a benign
twist. No, that's
twist.
Really dark.
But it's really dark, but it gets a laugh. So why does that get a laugh? But... I just don't understand. Mm-hmm. That is one of the things that brings me back to comedy over and over again, is that it really is a complete mystery. And because of that, it continues to always be challenging. There's always something to discover in it. People will claim, there'll be books that come out that claim that we figured out what comedy is. Mm-hmm. And you read it and you're like, this is bullshit. This is not... They haven't figured out anything. You can immediately come up with an example of something that doesn't fit into whatever their formula. The recent psychological person came up with. Mm-hmm. You know, and so it will be a shame, actually. I think whenever you know, maybe humans won't figure it out. Maybe supercomputers will figure out the true formula of comedy, and that will be it'll be a shame, because then computers will be able to come up with jokes and comedians will be out of business.
I like that you're sad about the possibility of a puzzle being solved. That is a puzzle you're essentially trying to solve every day.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't want it to be... You're like, I don't want the game to be over.
Well, Levi, it's all about the journey.
I'm gonna murder you.
Going back to what I was going to say way in the beginning about tones on stage, voice. I have a joke where I go on stage and I say, "Hey, is everybody drinking tonight? Cool. I was drinking last weekend with all my friends. Well, not all my friends, most of my friends. My mom. I was drinking with my mom. Well, we were having coffee, but I was sneaking whiskey in the coffee. She didn't actually know we were drinking together until I put the lampshade on my head. That's my favorite drunk gag. Once the lampshade goes in your head, then everybody around is like, this party just got real! Unless you're by yourself. You're just an idiot sitting with a lampshade in your head, crying. But at least if somebody walks in you, they can't see the tears because of the lampshade. But they can still see you masturbating, sir. So keep that in mind, in case you're on the bus or something. So I'll do that, and I point to somebody in the audience when I say, sir.
And you've now implied it's masturbating.
Yes. But that has that has a sort of Ellen DeGeneres sort of constantly flipping the reality of, and it's clearly a fictional story. It's clearly like I wasn't drinking with the lampshade on my head with my mom. It's just obviously a joke. So now I'm in this realm. I'm in this realm of being a jokey guy,
mm-hmm.
where what I say is not genuine. It's in the service of just humor, which is fine. That's kind of a, you know, Stephen Wright and Mitch Hedberg and Ellen DeGeneres sort of have that. You realize what they're saying is going to be a joke. It's not something based from their life that's true.
Mm-hmm.
But then I'll have a story that is from my life, that is genuine. So now the audience has to flip their brain over to this new character who is now he's actually talking about something that we...
Right.
And like that's what I was... So. Until I come up with a better solution, what I've done is I found that you can go from the jokey guy to a sort of ranty, cynical guy, and that they'll accept that, and then you can go to genuine guy. You have to sort of slowly transition as you go along, and the audience will come along with you in that case. But I can't. But I guess there's something to be said too, that people would say, well, Ben, you just haven't found your voice yet. That's why you're doing all these mishmash of styles. But I also sort of like doing different styles on stage. I like, you know, because then I'm working on a joke about makeup, which is sort of this satirical feminist rant, which is along the lines of some kind of thing that, you know, Colbert would do. And I'm not saying. It's nowhere near what Colbert can do, but it's that style of satire from the perspective of I sort of become the asshole.
Mm-hmm.
And as the asshole, I'm saying these things that are asshole things to say, but because my character is an asshole, everybody knows that, oh, I actually mean the opposite of
right.
that. Well, not everybody. Some people have a really hard time picking up on satire.
Satire is confusing.
Yeah.
My 8-year-old struggles with it.
She's tough.
She thinks she's being satirical.
Well, there's plenty of adults in the audience who struggle with satire. Yeah. Like, wait, really? Yeah. So I like the opening line of the joke is I have an ex-girlfriend who had a problem with makeup. We'd be late for an event, and she'd be putting on makeup, and I'd be like, "Come on, hurry up!" And she'd be like, "Oh, you don't understand. You don't have to wear makeup." And I was like, "Yeah, you don't either." She's like, "Yes, I do." And I was like, "Yeah, you're right." And so it starts with that kind of asshole thing, and then I flip it to the fact that, oh, but she's right. Men really don't have to wear makeup. That's not the expectation of society, which is a ripoff of women, because men look better in makeup also.
Hmm.
Brad Pitt puts on makeup if he goes into a movie. If he didn't sit in the makeup chair, you'd be like, who's that meth addict in the Brad Pitt movie? The beginning of Benjamin Button is Brad Pitt without makeup. So now I'm getting into a more political, and then I get even more political. Which I'm still sort
even
of...
Even more than Benjamin Button?
Well, just in terms of...
I know what you're saying.
Like, I talk
society?
About...
Yeah.
I start talking about the Supreme Court decision of money equals speech.
Mm-hmm.
And if... this is getting... I'm getting into my head right now. So,
yeah.
But this is a joke, a whole premise. It's about 5 minutes long that I'm working on right now. And I keep having to... One of the things to make it work is I have to say a line that will sort of shock the audience. Mm. That will sort of be like I'll say, like, I know women in here are thinking, why would we have to listen about our problems from a man? Well, it's because I am a man, so people listen to me.
Yeah.
And I throw these lines out, then they kind of laugh at that, and they're kind of shocked, and then I have to buy it back.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of keep doing that, but sometimes I lose it. If they're not the right audience, I can just totally lose them. Mm-hmm. In this respect. And right now I'm struggling, because this is going to be something I'm going to build and do for my Fringe show.
Mm-hmm.
And
because you're writing a new hour for that.
Yeah, and I'm writing a new hour. And it's just, it's not there yet. It's not ready. And it's going to take probably about 20 more times for me to say it on stage before I figure out exactly how this bit's going to go down and what the right balance is between being... pushing that political correctness and being on the side of true feminism. You can't just go on stage and give a feminist rant. That's not comedy. You have to, in fact, when you're doing a feminist rant, say stuff that is going to really offend feminists and hope that that's accepted because it's satire. And you'll have, even with somebody who is really good at it, like Stephen Colbert, have that hashtag cancel Colbert.
Mm-hmm.
Because people will be like, they just didn't understand the set that he's not actually a racist,
right? Even it was so blatant, and
even as
a
character,
yeah. Always, yeah.
And so you always face that, and I guess you just got to accept that as part of comedy. And but yeah, no. So I've been doing that, kind of just trying to figure out how to make these bits work. And I've tried to get, because when you're writing new stuff for like a Fringe show, I have to write so much stuff that I have to go on stage like at Acme's open mic on Mondays and do all new stuff, which means I bomb for 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the 7 minutes. And because that's embarrassing, I asked a bunch of other comedians to also do new stuff, and I turned it into New Stuff May. And so now we're all doing New Stuff May. There's about 10 of us doing New Stuff May at Acme, so it's basically just an hour of comedians bombing at the open mic now for this month. And all because I didn't want to, because I felt self-conscious about bombing myself. So. But it's also cool, because the more you write, the more you do come up with those gems. And in the end, you forget about all those times you bombed, and you're really grateful that you had you have this new bit that is that works for the audience.
Yeah, it just erases all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it ends up being worth it. But at the time, when you're on stage and you're bombing, it really doesn't feel worth it.
No, that's the weird thing, at least in my comedy experience. You can feel the worst you've ever felt and the best you've ever felt literally standing in the same spot.
Mm-hmm.
Which doesn't really make sense. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. You mean, like, with the same joke, or...?
Well, arguably, I mean, I don't know if I've had... I have had a joke that killed one night and then didn't work at all the next night. But more, I mean, just...
Yeah.
This is the same space I am where just the other day I was having the best night of my life. And yeah. Now I'm just flop sweating and just everything's the worst.
And the audience
I'm the same. The space is the same. Mm-hmm. What's changed? I mean...
Every audience is different. And sometimes jokes just... That's another something that really fascinates me about comedy is that there will be a joke that just works and works and works and then it just stops working. And it's a dead joke and it never works again. And you can sit there and go, well, this worked for a year. Every time I did it on stage, it worked. I never changed it. And now the audience will not laugh at this joke no matter what, where I put it in my set, no matter what. And it's just, why? There's no... I've tried to go online and figure out why that happened. There's no explanation for these weird things
in
comedy.
Why doesn't my joke work?
It's like... Well, it just is sort of like... It's not magical.
Mm-hmm.
There's no... There must be a reason why a joke works for a while, and then it just goes dead.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I haven't figured that out. But that's just that. And it's another mystery in comedy that just keeps me coming back to it. Well, I can't figure this stuff out, but I can sort of play in this field, and I can sort of come up with jokes that don't die.
Yeah.
So there must be something inherent in a joke that you write that puts a ticking clock on it that... Oh, this joke is, even if it's not a based off of current events, that for some reason it'll only work in this culture for this year. And then once this culture changes enough, that particular joke doesn't mesh with the psychology of the audience.
It's like a half-life, sort mm-hmm. of.
Yeah. And then other jokes will just work forever.
Yeah. Well, we are actually, we've run through our time. You're getting the light.
Yeah.
The terminology you can understand. Is it bensandell.com? Is that the best place to like find out dates or what do you...
Yeah, bensandell.com.
And that's B-E-N-S-A-N.
D-E-L.
Cool.
Yep.
Well, so thanks, Ben. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
The What's So Funny podcast is produced by mnartists.org with theme music created and performed by Mr. Deaver.